Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. This is a podcast as part of the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Mark McLish, who is Assistant Professor in Religious Studies at Northwestern. Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well on this Friday afternoon. It's Friday where we are. We have no idea when you're listening to this. It's Friday for us.
Right.
So today, we get to speak about a very interesting title. Interesting for me anyhow, the history of the Arthashastra, Sovereignty and Sacred Law in Ancient India. So, Mark, maybe a great place to start would be to talk about what it is you study and how you study it. So, for example, this isn't an ethnographic book where you're interviewing people. You are studying the Arthashastra. So, talk to us about what the Arthashastra is and how is it that you went about studying it for this publication?
Yeah, the Arthashastra is a manual of statecraft from ancient India. And by that, I mean it's something of a kind of instructional treatise on how to run a kingdom. And in that respect, it covers a lot of territory, everything from the education of princes to the law of royal courts to standardization of weights and measures to battlefield strategy, pretty much most everything you'd need to know to be a successful king. And I argue in the book that it was composed over a period of time. It was probably originally composed, or the original version of the text was composed sometime around the first century BCE. And then what I'm really trying to do in this book is to demonstrate that that text then underwent a redaction. An editor came in and made substantial changes to the text. And I placed those changes around the third century BCE. And what I try to do using textual criticism, we can perhaps talk about those methods if those are interesting to you, is to really identify the early material and the later material, if not, you know, in every detail, then in according to certain kinds of interpretive principles, and then to engage in a kind of diachronic comparison of material in the text as it pertains to the question of sovereignty and the sacred law of Dharma, particularly how, if at all, Dharma is understood to limit or impinge or shape the practice, sovereign practices of the king.
So obviously a fascinating topic. And as I mentioned, as we were chatting before we began, I may be biased because I study Indian kingship and my name happens to be Raj. So, slightly biased audience, but
yeah, sure.
Before we delve into the argument you're making in terms of the Dharma of the king, the method and theory. So you're studying this ancient Brahmanical Sanskrit text. Unlike, for example, one of our recent interviews with Jessica on reciting the goddess, you're not weeding through manuscripts. You're sort of doing something similar to what I did, where you have a very stable Sanskrit text that you're now interpreting in terms of historicity or in terms of themes. Would you say that's correct?
That's right. That's right. So we might make a rough distinction there between so-called lower criticism and the higher criticism. Lower criticism being the collation of texts and their comparison for the purpose of producing, in theory, the earliest recoverable form of the text, as opposed to higher criticism, which takes a version of the text, hopefully that version of the text, and then looks at internal indicators, internal features and characteristics, and tries to probe a little bit deeper historically. So yeah, I use Congleve's critical edition, which I think is, you know, for the most part, widely accepted. Its readings are widely accepted. And But the thing about the critical edition in this case is that the oldest manuscript for the Arthashastra is only fragmentary, and it probably only goes back to about the 12th century. So the version of the text that can be reconstructed through lower criticism is really the medieval version of the text. And to get any deeper than that, any behind that version of the text, then one has to look at what I think of formal features of the text, the kind of thematic structure of the text, and see if one can deduce evidence that shows how it might have been composed and how it might have changed over time. So that's what I do, right? Working with Congleyer's critical edition, trying to identify formal features and thematic features that give us some sense of its evolution.
Would you say you've adopted a fairly standard methodology? Would you say that engaging the Arthashastra has occasioned you to develop something novel in how you look at the text?
That's a great question. You know, I think higher criticism is the kind of thing, and of course, you know, the Puranas, right? Your field is an area in which this has kind of been most developed, but it's something that I think critical readers of texts are always kind of thinking about or thinking through anyway. I mean, when we look at parts of text and we see that, you know, two pieces of a text repeats one another, or there's some discord, or, you know, then we're starting to think about the processes through which the text was composed. And that is, in essence, what higher criticism really is trying to find those traces in the text that give us some sense about maybe how it was put together over time. Now, when it comes to establishing the principles for the Arthashastra, they're necessarily unique to that text. And I think that's true for textual criticism across the board. There are some things that texts will share in common, features they'll share in common that are salient to textual criticism. For instance, I talk about what I call redundant segmentation in the book, and that's the situation where in the Arthashastra is divided by two different segmentation schemes, neither of which is a subset of the other. So they truly are redundant. One does not, you know, depend on the other in a sense. And we see redundant segmentation all over Sanskrit texts. I think it's often a sign that the text was transmitted into an educational context where it was redivided into different kinds of segments for the purpose of different educational purposes. I think redundant segmentation arises often when commentators are looking at a text and they're kind of thinking through its different parts or establishing different segments to comment upon. So that's an example of something that I think that we see in the Arthashastra that's kind of generally applicable to textual criticism. But for the most part, the principles of a specific text critical study are highly dependent on that text itself. So when it comes to understanding or trying to come up with some kind of understanding of the development of the Arthashastra, everything is kind of right there between the covers, in a sense, right? The things that are salient and have to be made sense of are going to be unique to that text.
So the stability of the text, notwithstanding, it's clearly the work of many hands, which is part of the challenge of
right
Sanskrit texts.
Several hands, at least. And I'm getting outside of my wheelhouse here, but I'm increasingly convinced that this is the case with almost everything that we have. That our idea of the text as a single authored work is probably the exception in ancient India, at least, and that texts were embedded in traditions and that over time many hands worked on them as a rule, I would think.
You know, that sort of sums up the rationale behind asking after whether your methodological approach was novel or because it does seem that it's really difficult for we Western scholars to get over this idea of, you know, studying a text that's not a text in the way we think of a text,
right?
Not single authored. And so really in the Puranas, you know, it's a real challenge for some readers and scholars to get over that idea and not think of it as some kind of deviation
from right.
what the text is, as opposed to that being the text, the you know,
that's right.
Those branches are the banyan, right?
That's right. Or text tradition. I mean, and I don't know how valuable it is for me to get too deeply in the theoretical weeds in the theorization of text, but certainly that term is misleading, right? If by that we mean a kind of stable literary production that then kind of gets transmitted without changes over time. And most of these are text traditions, it seems to me, where you have something that's being passed down or transmitted within expert traditions, expert communities. And from time to time, they get abridged, added to, transformed in different ways. And I think one of the things that keeps people clinging to this idea of the text is that we would love to be able to date these things and then use them as roads, you know, as mileposts for the study of a period that has, you know, a kind of impoverished historiography in a lot of ways. And, you know, but as much as we want that to be the case, it doesn't mean that, you know, that the texts aren't going to, you know, play nice so that we can say 6th century, 4th century, 3rd century and be done with it.
It nevertheless seems that your book fills a gap or importantly comments on the dating of this text. No? Mm-hmm. That is part of a great part of your project, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some cases we're going to be able to, I mean, once we accept that the Artha Shastra, as I've accepted, I hope others find the argument convincing, that it's a period, it's a product of several different periods, then we can say some things particularly that are more specific and then say some things about history based on that. But I don't expect that will be the case in every circumstance. Certainly I think of things like the polycanon and the complexities in some of these texts are going to be, Pranas perhaps, are going to be too great to come up with kind of tidy models like I was able to for the Artha Shastra or like that I argue for with respect to the Artha Shastra. But certainly in some cases it should be possible to find examples of texts that can be dated in their development and give us a sense at least of how texts were composed and developed over time, at least certain instances.
So what's your primary interest in this text? What are you asking of this text? What are you probing this text for in this book?
Yeah, I mean, there's a part of me that is just fascinated with text and with Sanskrit language and that's the first part of the book and is just happy to ask questions about the text itself kind of for its own sake. I find it endless. The text itself endlessly interesting. The substance of it is endlessly interesting, and the kinds of traces left by the different hands in it are fascinating to me. And kind of trying to work through that as its own reward. But in historical terms, in terms of history of religions, the Artha Shastra it sticks in the craw of our image of ancient India a lot of times. The one that predominantly comes out of the epics and the Puranas and the Brahmanical ritual and religious literature, and that's what attracted me to the text to begin with. And through the early part of my education, had really, you know, a very kind of set view of spiritual India, religious India, you know, kings doing their dharma, this kind of thing. And when I was introduced to the Artha Shastra in grad school, it just was so surprising to me that culture could also produce a text like this. And as I thought about it more deeply, I thought, well, you know, in many ways, and I make this argument in the book, the Artha Shastra is a much better witness to what's happening at royal courts in the period than a lot of other texts. And this raises the question of genre and the ways that we do and don't theorize genre as part of our historical work on these texts. I mean, there's a tendency it's a kind of flattening tendency when we read texts to kind of get them to aggregate into one picture instead of really seeing differences in audience and differences in social location. But certainly the Artha Shastra has some kind of privileged perspective. There's really no other text that can convince us as much as it does that it understands how deliberations worked amongst kings and their ministers. And the surprising thing, as I argue in here, is that if we look at what I think is the original version of the text, it's quite clear that they were operating within what I would call in very heavy scare quotes, a secular context and from a secular perspective. And so to me, that's the challenge of the Artha Shastra. And I think it's repeated with different texts in different genres, but how do we get it to sit beside our other sources on kingship from the ancient period and make sense of their differences as part of the same kind of cultural milieu or cultural context? That's the bigger question. I don't really address that in here. This is what I think of as more the kind of foundational work that needs to happen before the text can be prepared in a sense for an engagement with a broader set of historical sources and different methods than I use.
Well, there's so much that's interesting in what you've just said. I mean, even the preamble to answering the question, the interest in how the text works. I mean, many folks go to a text with a question about what it's saying. And even before that, there's so much we can study about how it's saying it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, whether it's frame narrative, whether it's redaction, and what you say about what the text says, which you allude to anyhow, in terms of it being for those of you in the audience who may not be familiar, it really emphasizes, you know, the gore and grit and pragmatism of rulership.
Yes.
Which can be juxtaposed against the idealism that we see in the epics and the Puranas, and the pragmatism to me, I mean, with such idealism, mm-hmm. Represented in most ancient narratives in terms of who kings are or who they should be, mm-hmm. It seems that that very same culture must necessarily produce something very pragmatic.
Yeah, and kind of in a way surprisingly so, right? Not just for India, but for the ancient world. The Arthashastra is not just kind of unique in an Indian context, but in a global context too. And it's whatever, however we want to call it, it's pragmatism or it's realism. But, you know, the authors of this text, and I presume and I argue the experts in the statecraft tradition, had really in their minds conceptualized the sphere of governance as a field of action and organized their reflection on it in very empiricist and very pragmatic terms. And, you know, that's, there's a historical question there. How, within the kind of the more complex social reality of kingship, whatever that is, this very complex cultural assemblage, how does governance itself come to be isolated as a field of action? And then why does it take this, this very kind of pragmatic and empiricist, why does the text take such a pragmatic and empiricist approach to it? That's the same question, but in historical perspective, right? Where does this come from? What happens within kingship or within courts or within states that there is this, not just a space created for this, perhaps a necessity created for this?
That's the word that obviously there are no answers to these sweeping questions, but the word that comes to mind in terms of why is necessity.
Yeah.
It seems to me that when we study the Puranas and the epics, when we're, you know, in my brain at least, ideology is how things are imagined to be, mm-hmm. right? Whether we can't conflate how things were in the past and how things were imagined in the past. So these right. texts tell us that all these texts tell us is that there were people who imagined kingship to be this way.
Sure, that's
whether,
right.
Whether or not it was. And the Arthashastra very much to me is, it's what needs to be for kingship to survive.
Right. But I mean, that still raises some interesting questions, which is, you know, how did people become convinced that a materialist framework was the needful, in a sense, right? I mean, is it... in other words, at least to me, it seems remarkable that that there was such a clear-eyed sense of just the idea that efficacy can be traced or can be identified most easily in an empiricist framework, right? Cause and effect, you know, that you do X, you get Y. Y happens, it was caused by X. And this is where the state establishes its policies and carries them out. That still seems like a phenomenological perspective, and its emergence is something that has to be accounted for in a way. What's not clear though, and I still don't know if I have a good answer for this, is, you know, is the Arthashastra its own ideology? Is there an ideology of materialism and pragmatism here, or is it meant to be the kind of the private and interior dimensions of kingship, whose public face is the ideological or idealistic face that we're used to from the, you know, the Puranas and the epics and other sources, or were they incompatible? And at least in the minds of certain people, you know, was how would a Brahmin like Kautilya, just to kind of imagine a certain kind of figure like this, how would he have heard a Brahmin like Manu, or how would he have heard, what would he have made of the arguments about kingship that we see in the Mahabharata, that we see in the Puranas? Would he have said, yes, that's exactly right, but we still have to get some things done, so let's just focus on the needful? Or would he have said, these fools, you know, I hope they don't really believe this, or you know, and I don't know, that, I don't know. I mean, that's what I would like to try to figure out a little bit more.
Fascinating on the question. What most, there's so many points of entry for your data. What most surprised you? What most intrigued you in your journey with the Arthashastra?
I think that this text critical approach worked at all, you know, because how do you develop, right? How do you develop a model for the history of the composition of a text? And we are pattern seeing beings, whether those patterns are there or not, right? Faces in the clouds and all that. And as I started to kind of poke around and try to think about, a global model of the text, you're really just looking at local parts, chapters, and different passages, and you're starting to see things, that really you're developing a sense of what these patterns might be. But then that needs to be tested, right? So you develop a kind of hypothesis based on local conditions, and then you go to another part of the text and you see, can I get this to work here? And the biggest surprise was that it did end up working, more or less. I mean, I don't think that one develops a model of a text like this like one develops physical laws. You know, their texts are always going to be too slippery, I think, to be contained that way. But the fact that the model that I came up explained so many things for me elsewhere was a pleasant surprise. But you never quite know, because there's a lot of dead ends too that don't pan out, right? And I think that's the challenge of text criticism too, is to make sure that you're not higher criticism, that you're not convincing yourself that you're seeing something, that you're actually responding to formal features of the text and their relation. So that's one surprise. And then the two parts of the text, one is really strictly focused on what I think of as formal and thematic features of the text, and not on ideological features of the text. The second part is about the ideological features. So, as I approached this project, I admittedly part of my impetus was the recognition that a lot of what looked like dharmashastric, epic, Puranic kind of royal ideology was occurring in verses that were very, for lack of a better word, suspicious looking to me, their placement in the text and their location. There was always two parts to the inquiry, right? One was the kind of pure textual analysis, but the other was to see if I couldn't sort out some kind of chronological relationship in the text between different ideologies of kingship. And so the second surprise is that ended up working, that once I had the compositional model of the text, as I had, kind of hypothesized, nearly all, if not all, of what I would call the Varnashrama Dharma material, the kind of dharmic Brahmanical material, nearly all of it can be assigned to that later part of the text. So it worked. It worked both as a kind of a text critical model and as a kind of theory of the development of the political philosophy of the text over time.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Just to unpack before we proceed, the Varnashrama Dharma.
I mean, I use that as the kind of as the way it's often used in the dharmashastric material as a kind of shorthand for dharmashastra itself, or the orthopraxy and orthodoxy of dharmashastra. So Varnashrama Dharma, Varna, those are the well-known four social classes that can be traced back to the earliest, the latest parts of the Rig Veda, the Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. It really becomes a kind of shorthand for thinking about hierarchy and Brahmanical supremacy in India more broadly. Ashrama are the modes of life or the stages of life, the life paths, the four that are arranged in the Dharmashastras chronologically, the student, the householder, the forest dweller, and the renouncer. And Dharma refers, of course, to the kind of sacred cosmic law that has been, distilled from the Vedic revelation. And collectively, Varnashrama Dharma therefore refers to the entire body of sacred rules that pertain to the different social classes and modes of life. So rules for Brahmins, rules for Kshatriyas, rules for Vaishyas, rules for Shudras, rules for students, rules for householders. And this is the kind of matrix or organizational principle that the Dharma Shastras, the kind of, we can call them legal texts, we can call them the great texts of Brahmanical orthodoxy. This is the matrix or the framework that they use to organize their promulgation of sacred law. So when I say Varnashrama Dharma, I am talking about classes and modes of life. What I'm really talking about is that greater edifice of Brahmanical orthodoxy as it's presented in the Dharma Shastras. I don't know if that misses something big. Sometimes I assume so much about this that I have trouble explaining it.
Well, it's hard for us. We're so in it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so my job is to sort of, part of my job is to play the naive interlocutor.
Sure.
Or perhaps most of our audience thinks I'm a blithering idiot. I don't
know. You can't have it both ways.
I ask these questions like, so what's Varnashrama Dharma? Because I don't know.
I mean, it's Brahmanical orthodoxy, but in a very specific aspect. And that aspect is as comprised of divinely revealed rules and laws that we call Dharma. And the key sociological features according to which Dharma are organized are these hierarchical classes and these chronological modes of life. So when I'm looking for the presence of Brahmanical orthodoxy in the text, I'm kind of looking for the presence of Varnashrama Dharma, that is to say references to the sacred laws, as they pertain to these different classes and as they pertain to kings, right? Raja Dharma, which is usually seen as some kind of subset of Varnashrama Dharma, although its position in there is a little bit, shaky, I think. So looking for passages that, looking for passages that endorse Dharma, endorse Raja Dharma, endorse the idea that the king rules under this cosmic law, and that in order to be successful, the king must rule according to cosmic law, right? That in order to be successful as a king, as a politician, to have a society that's abundant and safe, and in order to be successful personally, to be doing the things that will bring him happy circumstances in the next life and the next world, the king has to follow Dharma. So that's what when I'm trying to trace Brahmanical orthodoxy, I'm trying to trace Varnashrama Dharma. Those are the kinds of things that I was looking for.
So the king is obviously the head honcho in terms of, I'm not even going to say that much. One may think the king is the head honcho, but the king actually belongs to the second class, doesn't he?
Yeah, right. So you're right. I need to back up a little farther.
No. This is in no way, shape, or form a critique. This is just an intrigue of mine.
That's right. Exactly.
In terms of like Brahmanical power and then royal power. Like,
sure. And this is what led to my interest in the Arts Shastra to begin with. So I'm glad you brought this up. Right. So in the Varna system, the pride of place, the highest rank is reserved for the Brahmins, who are the quote unquote priestly caste or class. And kings are in the second class, the Kshatriyas, which were nobles, aristocrats, warriors. And this is considered by, you know, a lot of observers, interpreters, and scholars to be a kind of a unique feature of Indian sociology, that here we have a society in which the highest status doesn't go to the king, that is to say to the individual with the army and the treasury and all of the material resources, but to the priest, and ideally the kind of poor priest or humble priest, you know. And what it suggests is that, you know, Indian society has been, and I would guess in this kind of thinking remains, a place that is so pious and so concerned with spirituality and spiritual goals that that the Brahmin has greater authority than the king. And this is the kind of, you know, stereotype thumbnail sketch that we get of society in ancient India. And it's been much critiqued. I don't want to act like I'm, you know, the only person critiquing this. And yet one still sees it all over the place. It's still one of the organizing principles that you'll see in historical texts and textbooks. And so this subordination of the king to the Brahmin is reflected in terms of political theology and the subordination of the king's sovereign power or his kshatra to the sacred law of Dharma. right? The Brahmins are the teachers and the promulgators of Dharma. They are the proximate sources of Dharma. And Dharma provides the rules that the king has to follow, again, if he wants to be politically successful and if he wants to take care of his soul in the next world. And so the model of Indian kingship is a kind of curiously disempowered form of kingship, right? That kings routinely surrender some dimension of their sovereignty to Brahmins and to Dharma because of their personal piety and because of the kind of general piety of the culture. And that's exactly what the Arthashastra undermines. The Arthashastra shows a style of statecraft and an approach to governance that pays no attention to Dharma and that does not recognize the superior status of Brahmins. Now, I need to back up there again, because the extant Arthashastra, of course, does have passages in which the text recognizes the king's submission to Dharma or the king's need to submit to Dharma and recognizes the high status of Brahmins, what I call Brahmanical exceptionalism. And it's precisely these passages that I've been able to assign to the later layer of the text that helps us to see that the original Arthashastra was pretty much completely devoid of any of that kind of political theology. So having separated the text into these earlier and later layers, and having examined the political philosophies of the early layers of the text, we see that our sole significant surviving source from the ancient Indian tradition of statecraft did not conform at all to this stereotypical image of disempowered kingship in ancient India. I guess I should have started there.
So, it's utterly fascinating. This is a journey, right? You never know what'll come between the exchange.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's just so much there, and I'm trying to parse out of my brain how much of my questions are self-serving. Which we can do some other time, and how much would give a broader context for the book.
I will say though, be self-serving, because the things that need to be hammered out with respect to kingship have to be hammered out by people who study kingship in detail from different perspectives and different genres. Because it's kind of like the blind monks and the elephant, right? So that conversation is very important, I think.
So here's a couple questions that come to mind. The Arthashastra in many ways seems to have undergone a journey from you can say practical political manual to something that has been theologized.
Yeah. And I would say admittedly lightly theologized. It's not as though the secularity of the Arthashastra was invisible to people who weren't working with my model of the text. It was just mixed or obscured a bit, but it still comes through very strongly in the extant source. So yeah, I would just add that footnote.
And so how would you regard these different strata of the text in terms of earlier and later? Would you privilege different kernels for different purposes, or how do you make sense of that?
How do I regard them as kind of witnesses to kingship in the period?
Would you say that the earlier kernels of the text would be more authentic?
Yeah, I want to stay away from the word authenticity because again, the idea that there's an authentic text that gets corrupted relies on that notion of text that we were talking about earlier, right? That there is a kind of single original text that then, you know, is either preserved or is corrupted. I think the question is, what does it tell us about the tradition of statecraft? What does it tell us about, you know, really the conversations that ministers had, the ways that they conceived the power of the state and the activities of the state, and then the way that they taught their pupils or their sons or however this tradition was transmitted, how do these two layers of the text tell us anything about that tradition? And I want to argue that the early Arthashastra really accurately reflects the statecraft tradition, at least, you know, from the early part of the classical period, and that it was a kind of decidedly pragmatic, empiricist, amoral, secular, kind of what have you, tradition. It has this reputation, certainly. And I'm building here on the works of the Russian scholars, and I'm going to get their names wrong, Vygotsin and Zamosvantsev, and they've argued that the statecraft tradition in India can be traced back to about the 6th century BCE under the rubric of Kshatra Vidya, right? The the science of rule or something like that. And that from an early period in the Jatakas and elsewhere, it has the reputation of being purely pragmatic and amoral. And this is its reputation, and this continues to be its reputation even after, you know, the period of the Arthashastra. But the fact that its kind of chief identity is its amorality lines up perfectly with what I see happening in the early Arthashastra, you know, a text that's not really parading around its amorality. I mean, at some points, I think it does exult a bit in the limitlessness of its kind of moral framework, but really is focused on success and pragmatism. So in my mind, these two layers of the text, the earlier layer gives us a kind of a better view into the statecraft tradition. And I think this is backed up in other ways. If we look at niti as a, so one of the predominant terms for the statecraft tradition is niti or niti shastra. And the Arthashastra, I think I argue that the early text called itself a danda niti instead of an Arthashastra. Another word, danda being the staff, the symbol of the king's power to punish, and niti being the term for governance. So leading by means of punishment or by means of the staff. If we look at the niti tradition, it's a technical governance tradition. It's interested in what we'd think of as the kind of routine and occasional activities that a king has to organize or a king's administration has to organize to keep a kingdom going. If we look at the Raja Dharma kind of stuff that we see in Dharma Shastra and in to some extent in Mahabharata, we see a much more ideological reflection on kingship. And so in my mind, the Arthashastra that, you know, kind of the earlier original Arthashastra really gives us a look into what the niti tradition was all about. Now, the significance of this later material is that after the Arthashastra, after the redaction of the Arthashastra, we don't encounter any niti texts that aren't already mixed with this Raja Dharma theology, this Raja Dharma political theology. That's what we see in the Mahabharata, and I'm assuming there that the down in the weeds, but I'm assuming that the Raja Dharma Parvan is a Gupta-ish era addition to the text. It's what we see in the Puranas. It's what we see in the strongly in the Dharma Shastras after Manu. But these don't really replace niti, the technique of niti, the technical aspects of niti that make it its own specific genre. They kind of layer an ideology over the top of it. So the big question becomes, why does this happen? If I'm arguing that the early Arthashastra shows us the niti tradition was really devoid of this kind of ideology, how come everything we have, including the Arthashastra, exhibits it? And so in my mind, there's a historical question, which is, did the tradition of statecraft undergo important ideological changes around the time that the Arthashastra was redacted? And I want to say yes, because this fits nicely in with the so-called Brahmanic revival in the Gupta or pre-Gupta period. It fits in with the advent of the Sanskrit cosmopolis. It fits in with the rise of the early part of the rise of what we think of as Puranic Hinduism and so many other things. So I want to use this this diachronic analysis, the Arthashastra, to ground a larger consideration of changes in the niti tradition, particularly what we might think of as the increasing influence of Brahmanical orthodoxy in niti, at least as our sources show.
I'm just one man, but it holds water in my opinion.
Good, great. That means a lot to me.
That's neither. I mean, we can chat after the interview is over formally. I mean, there will be authors on the program where I may not particularly agree with their findings. It's neither here nor there for the importance of the work and for mm-hmm. folks to engage it on their own terms. But mm-hmm. The argument makes sense to me. Clearly the work was theologized at some point.
Right.
And clearly the core of it is just, it's a scalpel, right? You could put a velvet handle on it at some point, but it's a scalpel, right? This is a very incisive text. It's the one word that comes to mind over and over again is necessity, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is what a king needs to do to maintain and wield power, power.
That's right. Right.
And so although the Indic tradition at large, I would say, subordinate social power to spiritual power, this text fits squarely into in one wing in its if not its origins and then in its center of gravity, right? It fits in terms of how do we deal with and work with and navigate the social sphere more than the spiritual sphere. I mean, both wings are necessary, but clearly this text is on one side of the bird, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So what now? So what, maybe I should ask you, was there anything in the book that you wanted to bring up that we didn't get to touch on in our back and forth?
I don't think so. I mean, it's as you know, it's very technical, you know, so a lot of what's in there, I eagerly await the response of other Sanskritists and philologists to kind of put the technical arguments to the test. But originally, I had really wanted in this book to branch out and ask some of these larger historical questions like we've been discussing in the last few minutes. And it turned into too big of a project. It wasn't going to get done in that form. So the book here is really trying to make a very specific argument about the art of Shastra in isolation. And then in the conclusion to begin to argue what's necessary to make more general historical conclusions based on the more specific conclusions of the study. And so that's what's next. What's next is stepping back and thinking about the development of the Niti tradition, as we talked about towards the top of the interview. Where did this isolation of governance as a field of action come from? How do we think about its historical sources? How do we figure out, as we were just discussing, how this pragmatic or needful approach to politics fits in with a much larger and more complex discussion around kingship and culture of kingship? And then finally, what happens in these crucial centuries, second, third, fourth, fifth century, that seems to imprint itself so clearly and permanently in a way on the statecraft tradition in ancient India? So that's the project for the next book. The heart of that will be a study of the Niti texts and really an attempt, I think for the first time or one of the first times, to treat Niti as an independent genre and discipline, because those who are familiar with it will know that the Artha Shastra has been routinely studied as a subset of Dharma Shastra, right? And therefore, the argument's been made that one has to assume all of the kind of precepts of Brahmanical orthodoxy while reading the Artha Shastra, even and especially when they're not there. And so there's a need, I think, just a basic kind of need to extract the Niti text as their own kind of tradition. I don't know if genre is the right word. And to try to tell a story of their history independent of Dharma Shastra. And I think that's the spine or the backbone of the study that will be able to address these other historical questions.
Well, then you will certainly have to return once that is produced.
Gladly.
Until then, we have more than enough to think through in Mark McLeish's The History of the Artha Shastra, Sovereignty and Sacred Law in Ancient India. Thank you very much for being on the program today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, until next time, keep reading. Bye.